Hello and welcome to the EUISS podcast, a conversation on foreign policy what-if scenarios. My name is Florence Gaub. I am the EUISS deputy director and the host of the show. And with me today is Katharina Mustasilta, our senior associate analyst working on conflict. Welcome, Katharina.
Thank you, Florence. It's great to be here with you.
You work on conflict. Now, conflict is something everybody worries about at the moment during this pandemic. You, of course, know that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a ceasefire back in March. Actually, an immediate global ceasefire of all ongoing conflicts. Now, you and I had a conversation already about what is actually a conflict, and apparently it's not as easy as we think to measure. But let's say 43 countries are currently experiencing some type of conflict. So his call concerns a lot of people. How is this call for a ceasefire been met, responded to?
Unfortunately, in general, what we're witnessing is not particularly encouraging, I would say. From those 43 conflicts that are measured by the armed conflict location and events data set, so the ACLED data set, they code around 10 to 12 countries that have seen some conflict actors either welcoming the ceasefire initiative or declaring a unilateral ceasefire as a response to the COVID pandemic. Yet the follow-up on these declarations and this kind of positive rhetoric that some conflict contexts have witnessed hasn't been all that good. There are a couple of examples that in the beginning looked quite positive. So in Colombia, for instance, the National Liberation Army, so the ELN, they announced a unilateral ceasefire as a response to the pandemic and did also kind of live up to that promise for the time of the ceasefire. Also in the Philippines, there was initial reduction of violence between the New People's Army and the government. Yet even with these more successful cases, now the last few weeks have seen again kind of fading off momentum of the ceasefires. And for instance, in the Philippines, violence has resumed. And then we have some countries such as Yemen and Libya, where despite a positive rhetoric response and even ceasefire announcement in the case of Yemen, we've actually seen escalation of armed dynamics rather than de-escalation of armed dynamics during the pandemic.
So it's fair to say that of the 43 countries, you said more or less 10 to 12 gave any response. We can say that 3/4 didn't respond at all. We don't know really what they made of it. So overall, we can say that the call for ceasefire has not really been well respected. Can you explain to me why?
Yes. So first of all, I would say that you're right. It hasn't really been respected. And I would go as far as saying that it shows kind of worrying trend of some armed actors using this announcing of ceasefires or welcoming a ceasefire initiative as a sort of cheap talk, while in the battleground, their response is very different. I'd say that there are three kind of interlinked reasons why the COVID pandemic is particularly hard on conflict dynamics. And the first is its global nature, right? In relation to a lot of other natural disasters or hazards that the situation was compared to, especially in the beginning, the crisis that we're facing now is influencing almost all of us. And that also means that a lot of our resources and attention is tight.
Can I just jump in here? Because you said the global nature makes it more complex. And then you referred to past, I think, natural disasters. I think we're thinking tsunami. So the tsunami helped in coming to a peace agreement.
It's often referred to as a successful case of a natural disaster that influences conflict parties negatively and thus can kind of incentivize conflict parties to start talking to each other, agree on a ceasefire, as was in the case in Indonesia in the Aceh conflict, that then later on actually contributed to a more comprehensive peace agreement. Now, why I said that this crisis is different because it's global is, you know, the tsunami, for instance, or other natural disasters such as prolonged droughts or floods. They usually influence ultimately a restricted geographical and political context, first and foremost. Whereas now we're facing with a crisis that influences all of us. And it also influences a lot of the global actors that are often very important when it comes to supporting conflict parties, to agree on a ceasefire, to move forward with peace processes.
It's a little bit like the fire brigade can't come and solve the conflict or help with the conflict because they're dealing with their own problem. Mediators can't act because they have to deal with the pandemic themselves. Is that what you're trying to say?
Exactly. Seizing opportunities for peace or even humanitarian ceasefire requires resources and time. So basically money and attention. And in the time of a pandemic, both of these might be particularly short right now.
So that was one of the reasons why we have more conflict or existing conflicts don't side. So one is the global nature. What are the other reasons?
Not only is this crisis a global crisis, but it's also a crisis that is both slow moving and it influences conflict parties in uneven ways. So from a state's perspective, the pandemic requires enormous efforts from an early point onwards in terms of reallocating resources to fight the pandemic, to design measures and implement them in terms of confinement and lockdowns that we've seen across the world, which obviously takes a huge amount of state's resources. Often this actually also includes, and we are seeing this in many conflict-affected countries, the deployment of security forces. Now, from a non-state group perspective, so a rebel group perspective, the crisis might not hit it as fast and as directly as it does the state. It takes time for the actual public health crisis to spread in a country. And in a lot of these conflict-affected countries, the virus itself has arrived at a relatively late phase. And already before that, the governments have been taking a lot of measures. So this kind of time in between the government taking already its measures against the pandemic and the non-state actors still being relatively untouched by the pandemic themselves, they might be able to seize an opportunity and try to further undermine and weaken the state actor.
So the pandemic weakens the state, but strengthens, or because it weakens the state, it gives a relative advantage to the non-state actor, which doesn't have to do any of, you know, what the state is doing. Broadly speaking, because of course there are non-state actors that do take state-like functions. And I think, do we not see in Brazil, in the favela, some of the organized crime elements enforcing the lockdown and things like that. But overall, that's the reason why non-state actors benefit, right?
Definitely. I would say at least in the beginning, and you raise a really important and interesting point with the criminal gangs in favelas in Brazil. And that's actually another way for non-state actors to benefit from this crisis. So indeed, there are a lot of non-state armed groups or militias or criminal organizations that do not only create havoc and crime and violence, but actually engage in a lot of governance functions. But still, I would argue that in the face of the pandemic, we tend to put the ultimate responsibility on the state, right? Even at an international level. International community pressures the internationally recognized states to act. Whereas the non-state actors, they might choose not to act in terms of trying to protect people or take some countermeasures against the COVID crisis, but instead kind of use their resources to weaken the already weakened state. But even if they actually choose, and they might do this while they increase their attacks on the state, even if they choose to try to gain more legitimacy by indeed actually taking a proactive stand and trying to show people, or at least acting as if they are doing a better job than the government in countering and responding to the pandemic, they might kind of be winning hearts and minds amid the crisis.
We have seen that the crisis impacts those that could provide peace or push for peace, so other actors that are not directly involved in the conflict. Now we've seen that it impacts unevenly, at least in the beginning, one of the conflict parties. But I know there's a third reason, and that's it also changes the dynamic when it comes to what they're fighting about, so resources. If we have, for instance, an economic downturn and there's less income, one of the reasons they're fighting about, this could become an additional reason on what they're fighting about, or how would you assess that?
Resources, of course, are being influenced very heavily. And I would say the longer we evolve in this crisis and the further the pandemic evolves, resources will become scarcer and scarcer in some contexts, and therefore fight over these resources might intensify. But I would actually say, as a third general reason for why the COVID crisis is particularly difficult today in terms of kind of seizing any opportunities for peace, is the international nature of many of the conflicts. And what I mean by this is that even if we have a conflict context where at some point both of the local conflict parties or all of the conflict parties locally are being hit hard by the pandemic, not necessarily by the public health crisis, but for instance, the economic fallout of the policy responses and the global response to the pandemic, a lot of the armed actors that we are talking about these days and we are facing these days get considerable amount of their resources, including arms and even troops, from abroad, from various different types of external actors.
You said actually in the first podcast season, you had a scenario together with Daniel where you talked a great deal about the fact that conflicts are much more international. So I invite our listeners to go back and listen to that. Is there any other reason why you think conflicts will probably get worse because of COVID? We have identified these three dimensions.
So related to the last reason, not only are conflicts more international, significantly indeed, than they were before, but just in general, we have a lot more actors, armed actors in conflicts today than we used to have. In addition to having external patrons and powers supporting local armed actors, we have more local armed actors, a lot of small militias, subnational groups that form part of these complex conflict systems. And obviously, if we now want to achieve some kind of sustainable humanitarian ceasefire, most of these groups should agree on it. And again, this goes back to what we were discussing before, given that the public health crisis and also the fallouts of it unevenly influence these different groups, it's kind of challenging to get all of them to agree on a ceasefire framework.
You are the editor of our conflict series. You look transregionally, different countries. I know that you're working on a brief that will look at five states in particular that were covered by the conflict series. Is there one that you want to walk us through as an example of how COVID has impacted that particular conflict?
Libya is one interesting, although quite worrying, example of how the pandemic crisis has thus far kind of escalated and complicated conflict dynamics. You know Libya well, and you know that the international efforts to achieve or support the conflict parties to start talking to one another, build trust and agree on sustainable ceasefire had already kind of been challenged before the pandemic. Now, the pandemic, as we've discussed, really hit hard those international efforts and just made them technically more difficult. And this, it seems, gave some space and room for the main conflict parties to rather try to go and act unilaterally and strive for better power positions in the conflict in armed ways. So actually we see in Libya, after the UN Secretary General's call for the ceasefire, which in the case of Libya had already been kind of called for before the global ceasefire initiative, violence from both sides increasing. And since then, we've seen several kind of unilateral acts by the two main conflict parties. And at the same time, Libya is a very interesting example of the influence of these external actors. So indeed, in the case of Libya, the internationally recognized party of the conflict, so the Government of National Accords, that is getting international support, especially from Turkey, has been able to continue armed tactics quite unabated amid the pandemic crisis. Same goes to some extent other side of the conflict. conflict. What is interesting, though, is that although we've seen in the kind of first weeks and first couple of months since the pandemic started, a very worrying trend in Libya when it comes to conflict dynamics, as the situation evolves, and especially as those external powers that support different parties in Libya are more and more influenced by the COVID crisis themselves, that might bring some opportunities when it comes to moving forward with ceasefire initiatives, for example.
One thing that's interesting about Libya is that you said earlier the state party is weakened more by the pandemic than the non-state actor. But in Libya, you don't have a strong state anymore. All parties are equally more or less affected or not affected by the pandemic. Really, the most interesting thing here is that in terms of conflict, what has changed or influenced it mostly is that the external actors have been focusing on something else. Although I would say that Russia clearly did not get that memo because they have actually stepped up their involvement in Libya, perhaps because they saw an opportunity in the fact that, you know, Europe in particular was focusing on the pandemic.
And that's why I think Libya is a very interesting example, because on one way, it does show this global distraction on the side of perhaps those actors that have at least tried to put forward peace talks and ceasefire framework or basis for that. And at the same time, it shows that local armed parties, if they continue receiving support from external actors, even amid pandemic within their borders, they might not be as negatively influenced by the crisis. So indeed, I would say in the case of Libya, it's also true, as you said, the state in itself is very weak and by definition contested at the moment. But both of the parties have still been able, at least as far, to continue trying to take advantage of the kind of global distraction that the pandemic has caused, because they have been supported by those external powers that again have perhaps also seen an opportunity in this crisis. But again, that might change depending on how the crisis influences those external powers.
We have assessed that probably all conflicts are likely to be exacerbated by the pandemic. The big question is, where is this going to go? And allow me to be devil's advocate here for a second, because there are, generally speaking, two ways of getting out of conflict. De-escalation is one, but escalation can actually also be the way forward. Could one not argue that actually inadvertently or indirectly, the pandemic might actually break a gridlocked situation or create facts that will mean that one conflict party accepts the end of the conflict? As I said, this is being the devil's advocate, because in a lot of cases, this might lead to a resolution of the conflict that we don't really like, because it, you know, isn't in line with everything we believe in, human rights, democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But is that also conceivable, that this could actually lead to some positive effects in terms of ending conflicts?
Definitely. And I think it can still lead to more positive effects, at least if we think about positive effects as cessation of hostilities between major armed parties. And that can indeed happen, one, by both of the parties being influenced negatively by the pandemic at some point, to the extent that external actors that support more conflict resolution approach actually are able to kind of pressure them and incentivize them to start talking rather than fighting. But it can also happen in the way that you just outlined, which is basically the crisis influencing disproportionately one of the conflict parties, to the extent that the power dynamics transform to a point where one of the conflict parties basically emerges as a winner in a conflict context, and thus can more, not unilaterally, but can pressure other conflict parties to a settlement that is more of their making. Now, another question is obviously whether these type of settlements will be sustainable or not. And I think that's actually one really important aspect that we should also consider during the pandemic, because there are peace processes that are ongoing amid the pandemic. whilst the pandemic might change the relative powers of those conflict parties that are involved in these peace processes. And we have some research that shows that obviously different peace agreements and settlements are more or less sustainable.
So when we sit here a year from now, what do you think we're going to say about how COVID-19 impacted the conflict? Do you think overall the balance sheet will be, it was a bit up and a bit down, but overall we are where we are, i.e. 43 countries seeing violent conflict? Or do you think it'll be more or less? Or if you don't want to say anything, tell me why.
Making these kind of predictions is hard. One thing that makes it very hard is that we are still probably at quite an early stage of the pandemic. And obviously those trends that we're witnessing now, the kind of opportunism that we're seeing from especially non-state armed groups, but also some state-based armed groups, and the kind of complications of peace processes and peace building initiatives might change as we go forward. One kind of positive opportunity that I see in relatively short-term future is that as conflict parties, both local conflict parties, but also those external actors that are supporting them, become more directly influenced by the public health crisis and its negative economic repercussions, that might kind of give us that momentum for at least some kind of ceasefire frameworks. But on the other hand, I also see that there are many worrying aspects in the crisis that make going forward in conflict-affected countries quite worrying.
Such as?
The way I see the crisis and its influence in conflict-affected countries is basically three-dimensional. So first of all, we have the public health crisis itself, right? And although the data that we get from a lot of conflict-affected countries cannot really tell us how and where the virus is actually spreading, what we can perhaps assume from looking at how the virus spreads in other societies is that it will most likely disproportionately influence those communities and those population groups that are already more vulnerable in their societies. And this, in the long term, can kind of reproduce perceptions of neglect and marginalization that in conflict-affected countries can go along those existing conflict cleavages, which kind of logically will not make peace processes or peace building within a society any easier. Then we have those policy responses that we've mainly been talking about today, right? Governments take different policy responses to the crisis, and unfortunately, it looks like these policy responses will not stop anytime very soon. And we might also kind of witness ups and downs when it comes to confinement measures and lockdown measures and movement restrictions. And these measures will continue making or giving opportunities to different conflict actors while hindering other opportunities, again, especially that of peace building actors, international support.
We were very worried, or we are very worried in Europe, that the crisis will give an excuse to authoritarian systems to increase their authoritarian hold on their societies. What we do see, however, is in some cases, well, I'm thinking Iraq, I'm also thinking Lebanon, for instance. Okay, Lebanon is not an authoritarian state, but still, that the state does not have the necessary resources to actually enforce its authoritarian ideas. Even in Egypt, which did actually increase this authoritarian hold, you know, introduced new laws and so forth, a lot of people actually ignored the lockdown rules because they had to go to work. So I think there's an interesting test case here to be made about, can these authoritarian states actually enforce their authoritarian dream? And where they cannot, I think the population will learn that their state is actually not as authoritarian as it'd like to be.
We see indeed some states that might not have the capacity to actually take the measures that they are pressured to take in terms of public health protection and lockdown measures, but they are using the pandemic and the pressure to take these measures to accelerate authoritarian and militarization tendencies, within the states. And I would actually argue that these gradual power grabs by either authoritarian-minded leaders or countries' military forces might then, in mid to long-term perspective, accelerate and spark state-society conflicts in the form of civil unrest against these type of moves. And I would say that indeed, rather than showing perhaps the weakness of the state, the demonstrations that we've seen and also the resurgence that we've seen of civil unrest and civil protests in a lot of countries as they take gradual steps to open up is more of an indicator of a bigger, longer trend that we've seen with nonviolent mobilization against authoritarian tendencies and for more open and democratic governance.
So now, what do we do? What do we do as Europeans to mitigate the effects, perhaps contribute to conflict resolution? And what do you think, as a conflict researcher, we should be doing?
I would start with the ceasefire initiative. Even though it hasn't thus far been very successful, we are still, again, in the beginning of the global crisis. And as we've discussed today, I think as the crisis evolves in many conflict-affected countries, different conflict actors might become more easily incentivized to agree on ceasefire frameworks, particularly, again, if those external supporters and actors that they are allied with are also negatively influenced by the crisis. So I would say that it's very important to keep the momentum alive for the ceasefire framework. And regarding that, it's important, and that's really where international actors such as the EU can play an important role, that the ceasefires that hopefully we might see in the future will be clearly defined. For instance, we'll have some sort of monitoring and perhaps even sanctioning mechanisms. And here, obviously, external actors such as the EU or the UN can play very important roles. Second, I think this crisis really underlines the importance of local peace-building actors, of locally embedded initiatives and actors that can continue important peace-promoting and peace-building work, even if international actors are forced to evacuate or are not able to move as freely as before. And I mean, we've been talking about the importance of local ownership in peace building and peace processes since really forever. But I think now a lot of us are, when I say us, I mean more in the Western Hemisphere, we are realizing the practical importance of that principle. And here again, international actors have an important role in supporting and perhaps developing more institutionalized way to support local actors in their peace-building activities. And third, I would emphasize the importance of sustainable and sufficient economic support for conflict-affected countries. The danger is that with the pandemic, again, because it influences all of us and it's, as we all know very well, it's hitting, for instance, European countries in a very hard way when it comes to economic development. And one danger that from a conflict researcher perspective I see here is that that will negatively influence the support that we give to conflict-affected countries. For example, in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, the UN peacekeeping operations lost around 20% of their funding. And now we're facing one of the worst global recessions in history. And so there's a big risk that this will negatively influence in the long term how we are able to support peace processes.
And peace processes that matter to us, we should say, because some countries, of course, are very close to us. This is a really long-term strategic issue. Thank you, Katharina, for joining me today on this bit depressing, but still extremely important topic.
Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening to us. Tune in again for another What If scenario next Friday.